Penn State's reputation in the fashion industry is something you would hear from everyone when you're in New York City.
I will say we're quite well known for being hard workers.
Kent is really known for delivering well-rounded students.
Kent has one of the most prestigious fashion programs in the U.S. and also internationally ranked.
Our alumni are in every corner of the industry, every job position that you can imagine.
They all are ready. They have all the courses. They have everything under, you know, under their belt.
Tonight on The Readout.
So to be clear, Mr. Trump has no financial relationships with any Russian oligarchs.
That's what he said. That's what I said. That's obviously what our position is.
Humana, humana, humana. Paul Manafort mumbling his way through a 2016 interview with CBS because he himself had extensive Russia ties. Now Trump is reportedly planning to bring him back as another loyal Trumper, Peter Navarro, heads off to prison. Also tonight, Judge Aileen Cannon's unusual request for jury instructions, which legal experts are calling insane, bizarre, clumsy, amateurish. You get the idea. Plus, polls will close soon in Ohio, where three Republicans are competing to challenge Senator Sherrod Brown in a race that could decide which party controls the Senate. But we begin tonight with the former president's crime syndicate. Trump White House aide Peter Navarro is, as of today, locked in a federal prison. Day one of a four-month sentence. Before turning himself in, Navarro held a press conference at a strip mall parking lot down the street from the facility. He was convicted of contempt of Congress for refusing to comply with the January 6th committee. He even asked the Supreme Court to help him avoid prison time as he appealed his conviction, but ultimately he failed. And now he's in prison, making him the very first Donald Trump senior aide to serve time in connection with the coup plot. Trump has to be afraid watching one of his top aides getting locked up. Though over the past couple of years, the cells have been filling up with these guys. Roger Stone, Michael Cohen, Rick Gates, George Papadopoulos, Steve Bannon, Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, Alan Weisselberg, his very own Trump organization, fined more than $1 million for tax fraud. All the president's men now have criminal records. Or rather, all the four times indicted, twice impeached, adjudicated sexual abusers, men. In that list of Donald Trump's very best people, I mentioned Paul Manafort. Remember him? If you've been following us during the MAGAfication of U.S. politics, then you certainly would remember Manafort, the key aide who seemed to appear out of nowhere to run Trump's campaign for free. He actually had some legit D.C. cred as a Republican consultant with ties to Presidents Bush and Reagan. During the Reagan era, he founded the Washington-based lobbying firm Black, Manafort & Stone. The Black being Charles Black and the Stone being none other than Roger Stone, the Trump foot soldier and Nixon zealot who would one day get pardoned by Trump for multiple felony convictions. Stone is the one you see there in the center. Manafort is on the left. Left. For the Washington Post, one of Manafort and Stone's first clients was a New York developer named Donald J. Trump, brought into their portfolio by Stone, who'd met him through the notorious Gotham lawyer Roy Cohn. You really can't make this stuff up. But as all of this firm stuff was happening, Manafort cooked up this side hustle that eventually blew into quite the lucrative gig. But not necessarily one you wrote home about, because Manafort's specialty became working for literally the world's worst people. He was this mercenary lobbyist. One of his clients was former Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos, who hired Manafort when he needed an image boost. The year after Marcos hired Manafort, in 1986, Marcos won the country's presidential election thanks to rampant voter fraud. And his wife Imelda became famous for shoe-horting while her country went broke. The dots are all connected here, right? But get this, Manafort was also a lobbyist for the opportunist dictator of then Zaire, the current Democratic Republic of Congo, Mobutu Sese Seko. Manafort functioned as Mobutu's de facto PR guy, and Mobutu, like Marcos, was a bad guy. In this 1989 article, The Washington Post writes of Mobutu, "He keeps coming back to Washington with his hand out, and Congress keeps filling that hand in spite of the human rights abuses in Zaire and the inexplicable lack of progress by the country under his reign. The Republican administration winks at Mobutu because he has been a cooperative ally in Africa, and those are in short supply. But some Democrats are fed up with paying for a corrupt and abusive dictatorship. Now, remember, Manafort also helped steal the Ukrainian election for a Putin ally. And he went from doing that to working for Trump. And despite all of these people he worked for, dictators accused of human rights abuses and who lived lavishly as their people starved, it was Trump he took the fall for. And now, supposedly, Manafort is back, with Trump eyeing him for a 2024 campaign role. The timing? Very interesting. Trump is bringing him back at a time when he desperately needs money. Cough, cough, Tish James and New York civil trial. And Manafort is the who are you going to call guy when you desperately need cash or to steal an election so that you can become president and use the presidency to enrich yourself and your family. The man lives lavishly himself. He owns a $15,000 ostrich feather coat. He's friends with dictators and the oligarchs no one has ever heard of. Has him on speed dial, I'm sure. And during his four-decade career, he, well, kind of became an oligarch himself. Joining me now is Michael Isikoff, investigative journalist and co-author of Find Me the Votes, all about the Georgia crisis. And we're going to bring you back to talk all about Georgia, because it's a whole mess down there with that prosecution. Talk to me about Manafort, because he also kind of played ball in the Trump campaign with a Russian spy.
Yes, he did. I mean, look, I'm having flashbacks to 2016 now. I mean, Manafort was sort of the first red flag when I and other people started reporting into the Trump world's ties to Russia. You had Trump, of course, who was saying all these nice things about Vladimir Putin while he was trying to do a business deal in Moscow. But when he brought Manafort in, that just raised all sorts of questions. Yeah. Manafort, as you pointed out, had been the political consultant for years for Viktor Yanukovych, who was the pro-Putin president of Ukraine at the time, or up until 2014. Yep. The Maidan uprising took place. And
the Orange Revolution, they called it.
The Orange Revolution, and he flees to Moscow. That had been, so Yanukovych was Manafort's main patron for years. And all the money from the Party of Regions, which was Yanukovych's party, came from oligarchs who were close to Putin, many of whom Manafort had all these ties to.
Yeah.
Oleg Deripaska, a name from the past.
Yeah.
I'm sure you remember. I mean, he was a business partner of Manafort while he was considered one of the two or three oligarchs closest to Vladimir Putin, had all sorts of suspected ties to organized crime. The U.S. government wouldn't let him in the country as a result of that. And here's Manafort not only doing business with, not only representing him, but they did business together. And then they fell out.
Yeah.
And this is what really got me. This is May of 2016. I discovered that Deripaska, the pro-Putin billionaire, is suing Manafort in the Cayman Islands because because millions of dollars in their business deal disappeared. So at the very moment that he gets hired by the Trump campaign,
he's in hock
to a Russian oligarch who was tied in with Vladimir
Putin. And so the giving over of non-public campaign data to someone who turns out to essentially be a Russian spy.
Yes.
That, and also when he then takes over the Trump campaign, changing only one thing in the Republican platform, which is to remove the plank in the Republican platform for support for Ukraine.
Right.
Putting all that together, Donald Trump is now desperate for money.
Yep.
And the only way that he can stay out of prison is to become president. Is it suspicious to you that he's bringing this specific guy back in who has ties to Russian cash and he helps steal elections?
Look, I think it's going to be suspicious to a lot of people. Let's go back to the Senate Intelligence Committee report, which was, you know, they spent years investigating this bipartisan report. And they concluded that Manafort, because of one of his closest associates, was this guy, Konstantin Kalimnik, who was viewed by the FBI as a Russian intelligence asset. Manafort is meeting with him while he's chairman of the Trump campaign and sharing internal polling data with him at the Grand Havana Room in New York. Senate Intelligence Committee report described this. It said Manafort was a grave counterintelligence threat.
Mm.
Who was the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee at the time that report was released.
Was it Marco Rubio?
It was Marco Rubio. So one question, you know, you and others might want to ask of Marco Rubio, is he comfortable with somebody who he declared to be a grave counterintelligence threat working for the Republican nominee?
Michael, you know his answer will be whatever Trump wants, whatever Trump wants. Michael Isikoff, a fantastic journalist. We're going to bring you back to talk about Georgia in that case. Thank you
love
very much.
Love to do it. Friend. Thank
much
you.
Appreciate it. Good to see you again. All right. Sure. Let's bring in Congressman Adam Schiff of California, a candidate for United States Senate and a former member of the January 6th Select Committee. Hopefully you were able to hear Michael Isikoff. Great journalism there. But are you concerned, Congressman, from a national security perspective, that Donald Trump, who is desperate for money and who needs to be president in order to make the cases against him, the federal cases, go away, is turning to Manafort again?
Absolutely. And, you know, let's remember that during that 2016 campaign, while Manafort is the chair of the campaign, he's secretly meeting with this Russian intelligence officer or operative, Konstantin Kalimnik, as you were discussing, giving them internal campaign polling information. This is the same Russian intelligence that is hacking and dumping the DNC documents, that is, you know, working with a troll farm in St. Petersburg to try to, you know, essentially run a covert social media campaign for Donald Trump. So he is effectively the liaison between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence. And he, as part of that relationship, he's also involved in a pro-Russian plan for eastern Ukraine. What could there possibly be to worry about in having someone like that brought into a presidential campaign again? Not to mention the fact that he was tried and convicted of various fraudulent activities, including those around not registering as a foreign agent, involved with trying to intimidate other witnesses. And we don't know even more about his role and his relationship with Russian intelligence because he used encrypted apps and he refused to cooperate when it came to Kalimnik. So all kinds of sirens going on with this prospect.
And by the way, it does kind of make you sit back and think about the fact that Donald Trump said he would allow Putin to do whatever the hell he wants to our NATO allies. And he's doubled down on getting his apparatchiks in the House of Representatives to refuse to fund Ukraine. Donald Trump needs money. Vladimir Putin might be the world's richest man because he's robbed all of the oligarchs that he has under his control. Does it concern you that perhaps what Donald Trump is hoping to trade for help from Russia again to get himself back in the White House is Ukraine?
Oh, absolutely. You know, what we saw in the first presidential campaign when he was lying about having any business dealings in Russia, even as Michael Cohen, his lawyer, was on the phone with the Kremlin right up to the point of the Republican convention, trying to make this deal for Moscow Trump Tower, something that Bob Mueller found would be the most lucrative deal of Donald Trump's life. He was willing to do that even when he wasn't in all this kind of debt that he is in now with these judgments against him. He is more financially imperiled now, I think, than ever before. More economic incentive, more greed operating here now than in the past. And Ukraine is in a much more vulnerable position. He has a lot more to offer the Kremlin dictator. So it is a grave, as the Senate bipartisan report said, a grave counterintelligence risk to have Manafort anywhere near that campaign.
In addition to that, we know that Donald Trump is his facing maybe, I don't know if the trial will ever happen because Judge Aileen Cannon doesn't seem interested in having the trial ever happen. But if that case were to go forward, Donald Trump is accused of stealing national security secrets up to and including nuclear secrets that he is also accused of sharing with people who didn't have or the right to access to them. How would we even find out if Donald Trump decided that that is something that might be something that's useful for Manafort to broker around the world? I'm just trying to think, you know, use my lurid imagination with Donald Trump, which I think we sometimes have failed to do.
Well, you know, it doesn't really require that lurid of an imagination. It just requires recollection. You'll recall in his meeting with Putin when he essentially banished everyone out of the room. He didn't want witnesses to his conversation with Putin. And as I recall, I think he was reliant even on the interpreter or the Russian interpreter. I don't even know if it was his or Putin's. So there's lots of reason to be concerned about any private conversation he might have with Putin, but also whatever he would relate to Paul Manafort about national security or intelligence matters that might be of interest or value to Russian intelligence. It's exactly the reason why I think when the intelligence community briefs him as the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, they're going to really dumb down anything they tell him because they know they can't trust him with whatever they share.
I have two more quick questions. One, your reaction to Peter Navarro now finally serving time.
Well, I think it's very important affirmation of the fact you can't just thumb your nose at a subpoena. There's no separate standard for cronies of Donald Trump. And without a penalty like going to jail, when people receive congressional subpoenas, they'll just say, well, this is optional. Now, I think a congressional subpoena has real teeth, and that's vitally important for our oversight role.
Let me play you a piece of sound of Donald Trump with apologies to how offensive it is and get your reaction.
When you see those Palestinian marches, even I'm amazed at how many people are in those marches. And guys like Schumer see that. And to him, it's votes. I think it's votes more than anything else, because he was always pro-Israel. He's very anti-Israel. Now, any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion. They hate everything about Israel, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
Congressman, you yourself have faced some of those pro-Palestinian protests. Some of the protesters are themselves Jewish people. What do you make of the idea that Donald Trump has said that anyone who doesn't vote for him hates their religion if they are Jewish?
You know, it's hard to begin to explain how offensive that is. It ought to be offensive to everyone. It's certainly offensive to anyone in the Jewish community. But the idea, the very idea that Donald Trump would think he's in a position to be advising Jewish people about their own faith, he's not in a position to advise anyone about anyone's faith. If he knew even the first thing about Judaism, he would understand, you know, the obligation of tikkun olam, the respect we have for efforts to mend the broken parts of our world. And if anyone is the antithesis to those Jewish values, it is someone like Donald Trump, who is so determined to divide, pit American against American, and further break this very damaged world we live in.
Yeah, he might want to stop saying Hitler did good things before he yes. starts advising Jewish people on what they ought to do and how they ought to vote. Congressman Adam Schiff, thank you very much. And up next on the readout, Judge Aileen Cannon has already shown her affinity for Trump throughout the classified documents case, but her new and super bizarre jury instructions take that deference to a whole new level. The readout continues after this.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
We are still more than a month away from the day the Supreme Court will begin hearing oral arguments on Donald Trump's presidential immunity defense. Today, Trump's lawyers laid out their supposed legal arguments on why Trump should be given a free pass for his efforts to try to overturn the 2020 election and for fomenting the ensuing January 6th insurrection. One of their claims is that, quote, the long history of not prosecuting presidents for official acts, despite ample motive and opportunity to do so over the years, demonstrates that the newly discovered alleged power to do so does not exist. Now, it is true that this is the first time a former president has faced criminal charges. But that's because it's the first time a former president tried to overthrow the peaceful transfer of power with the help of a mob of supporters he summoned. It is worth noting that Trump's lawyers used the term official acts more than 70 times in this filing, trying to make it seem that this was all in the purview of Trump's role as president. And the Supreme Court's decision will not only affect Trump's federal election interference trial, but some of his other criminal trials, including his classified documents trial in Florida. To that, Judge Aileen Cannon, who Trump appointed after he lost the 2020 election, is taking actions that are calling into question her legal inexperience, her partisan leanings, and whether she's essentially auditioning for a role replacing one of the conservatives on the Supreme Court should they retire under a Trump presidency. She has called on both Trump and the special counsel to file proposed jury instructions for use at the end of the trial, one that she has yet to even set a start date for. Included in the order are two different hypothetical situations she has asked both sides to consider for those instructions. Scenario one is that a jury of ordinary people with no security clearances should be allowed to comb through the highly classified documents Trump took from the White House and decide for themselves if national security information regarding, for example, our nuclear program should not be considered Trump's personal mementos. And in scenario two, that a president like Trump does have the broad powers to make that decision for himself and as such cannot be questioned over what he decides to take with him when leaving the White House. Now, I'm no lawyer, but that sounds insane to me. According to MSNBC legal analyst and former FBI general counsel Andrew Weissman, there is no legal basis for either of those choices. And it looks very much like she's trying to engineer a situation where either Trump can be easily acquitted of the charges or it just becomes almost impossible to convict him unless special counsel Jack Smith is okay with people without security clearances gaining access to the country's highly protected secrets. Joining me now to try to make it make sense is the great Mary McCord, former acting assistant attorney general for national security and co-host of the Prosecuting Donald Trump podcast. Can you make it make sense, Mary?
It's hard to do so. And let's just say she also just completely ignored all of the legal arguments put forth by Jack Smith and his team. Things like, you know, he's not charged with what he did while he was in the White House.
Right.
He's charged with retaining these classified documents, this national defense information.
In Florida.
After he left in Florida and not returning in when he was asked. And so the Presidential Record Act and whether he tried to designate him personal or not doesn't matter. But they also argued, I think more fundamentally to this point, that there are definitions in the Presidential Record Act of personal records and presidential records.
Right.
And personal records must be purely personal that are not related to information prepared for presentation to the president or prepared by the president related to his constitutional, statutory, and other official duties. Now, what could be more related to his constitutional and statutory duties than this intelligence community, raw intelligence community products turned into classified documents
right.
shared with the president? So this is not something where she has to hypothesize, should we let a jury determine whether these are personal or not, or should we let a jury decide whether he, you know, by merely not giving them to the archivist, that necessarily meant they were personal. Should we let a jury decide that these are these legal questions about whether a document like that could even be personal or
right.
presidential? She should be addressing.
And also, what judge thinks, you know, I was saying to you in the break, that Joe Slobotnik can look at these and be like, you know what, this looks like it said nuclear on it.
Yeah.
I think that might not be personal. That's how would they even know that? Do they have to get security? Like, that doesn't even make sense.
Well, mind you, they will be seeing some of these materials in order to rule on whether there's national defense information in the materials. But that's a completely different assessment. And I think, you know, your intro really hit the concern here. If she had just ruled as a matter of law, if she either decided to dismiss the indictment or dismiss charges 1 through 32, that's something that Jack Smith could appeal.
Yeah.
By doing this, she's not really issuing an appealable ruling. She's just trying to kick the can down the road to trial. And once you are in trial with a sworn jury, if she grants a motion for judgment of acquittal at the end of the government's case, that's not an appealable.
Wow. Is there anything Jack Smith can do?
So there is something called a petition for a writ of mandamus. I mean, this is where you go to the appellate court and you say what the judge has done is so clearly and indisputably wrong that it should be just overruled immediately.
Okay.
That is a very difficult standard to meet. It's one that I think is very questionable here because this is still just her sort of saying, give me these Just write that up for me. So I think that Jack Smith and his team are probably really considering it. I don't know that they'll use this this particular order to do it.
She's going to dismiss this case, right? She's going to let him off.
If she dismissed the case before trial, that would be better because they could appeal that. The most danger is that we're in a trial. She grants a judgment of acquittal in the middle of a trial, and then there's no
and then
there's
and then it's a legal. What do you call it? Double jeopardy. That's right. Okay. Let's talk about this. This is the here it is. This is Donald Trump's filing to the Supreme Court. He's trying to make the claim that Trump's actions, reaching out to state officials and Congress and his vice president, was based on some extensive evidence of fraud that's like apparently secret that he's never shown us before. Doesn't he have to show this evidence? And isn't it weird that he'd be also showing it to Clarence Thomas, whose wife also believes in the big lie, mm-hmm. and she thinks there was fraud? Maybe she has the evidence.
This is recycled from what he's been filing, you know, since he was before Judge Chutkan in the D.C. Circuit. Everything I did, everything Jack Smith's indictment charges me with is part of my official acts. Of course I can talk to state legislatures about fraud mm-hmm. in the election. Of course I can talk to my own vice president about fraud in the election. Mm-hmm. Of course I can talk to my own Department of Justice. So he's just trying to paint the facts in a way that gets him within his official acts.
Right.
And then to argue, you know, justices of the Supreme Court, I should be immune for everything that I do within the outer perimeter of my official acts.
But where is the talking part of bringing of having your people bring a noose to hang Mike Pence? Because that's not talking to him. Now, at that point, you're actually threatening to kill him.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, he would say that's just what
just talking
supporters,
loud.
The supporters did, that he never said that. I mean, we know that there's evidence when he was advised that reporters are said that. He did say something along the lines of, well, maybe he deserves it. But he would say, I certainly never ordered them to go hang Mike Pence. And I think, you know, he's got at least a good argument. He did not order that specific thing.
Yeah.
But his official acts argument is necessary for him if he's going to make any headway with
shot.
The Supreme Court.
Last one, really quick. This whole thing about now Donald Trump is suing ABC News over the fact that the word rape was used. Now, I feel like when you're arguing whether you sexually abuse someone or rape them, you probably are in a wrong place in the argument. You probably don't want to be there. But what the judge literally said was this. The finding was that Ms. Carroll, that she failed to prove that she was raped within the meaning of the New York penal law does not mean she failed to prove that Mr. Trump raped her, as many people commonly understand the word rape. That's what the judge wrote.
That's right.
Does Donald Trump have any road to stand on here?
No. I mean, I think it was George Stephanopoulos. He was basically using the same terminology that a judge has used. So you've got to prove, remember, with definition, that it's a knowing falsehood. And obviously, it's not a knowing falsehood when you're quoting the judge. And I'll just say, you know, sexual acts are defined in U.S. code and many codes, including any type of penetration with any part of the body.
Mary McCord, you always make it make sense. Thank you. Even when it actually doesn't make sense, but you make it sound good. And I appreciate you make it very simple to understand. And we always appreciate that. We didn't go to law school. Now, I kind of wish we did. We all needed apparently.
Wish you could have.
We needed to. Thank you, Mary McCord. And coming up, Steve Kornacki is at the big board as polls are just now closing in the state of Ohio, where we're following a very consequential race that could determine control of the United States Senate in November. Stay right there.
10 State's reputation in the fashion industry is something you would hear from everyone when you're in New York City.
I will say we're quite well known for being hard workers.
Kent is really known for delivering well-rounded students.
Kent has one of the most prestigious fashion programs in the U.S. and also internationally ranked.
Our alumni are in every corner of the industry, every job position that you can imagine.
They all are ready. They have all the courses. They have everything under their belt.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Polls are now closing in the great state of Ohio, and while the presidential nominations are settled, of course, there's also a big Senate race on the ballot. National political correspondent, the Kornackster, a.k.a. Steve Kornacki, is at the big board. Steve, what you got?
Well, Joy, the polls are closed in Ohio, and the votes are starting to come in here in the Senate race. And the dynamics here, Bernie Moreno, the businessman who's backed by Donald Trump, Matt Dolan, the state senator, Trump has been attacking. Dolan has said the 2020 election was won fair and square by Biden. He's put blame on Trump for January 6th. And the third candidate, the Secretary of State, Frank LaRose, who's tried to get Trump's endorsement, failed in that, but has tried to position himself as a Trump-aligned candidate. So two counties now with votes coming in. And the key thing in these early minutes in Ohio is the votes you're going to see early are the mail-in ballots. They are counted, tabulated, and released first. So the mail-in vote here in Warren County, this is just outside Cincinnati, Mason, Ohio, about 40,000 people, if you're familiar with the area, is around there. Bernie Moreno leading here in the votes that have been released, 47%. You see Dolan a little bit more than 11 points behind him, and then LaRose in third. This should be, if Moreno's having his night, he should be winning here. He should be winning here fairly comfortably. And again, if this is indeed the mail vote, which we believe it is, the mail vote in the past, when Dolan ran for the Senate back in 2022, he did better with the mail-in vote than he did with the same-day vote and the early vote. So this may be sort of a high watermark for Dolan in this county. We'll see as more votes come in. And the other place we're getting votes from, this is one of the mother lodes in the state. This is Franklin County. It's where the state capital of Columbus is. A lot of suburbs around Columbus as well. This is one of only three counties in Ohio that Matt Dolan won in the 2022 Senate primary. He lost to J.D. Vance in that primary. So this is a place where Dolan wants to get big, big numbers. You see him with what we think is the mail vote here, leading by about 12 points over Moreno. Dolan wants to get that number as high as he can in places like Franklin, in places like Cuyahoga, the big counties here with lots of suburban metro areas, lots of college degrees. That's where he needs to run up the biggest numbers if he's going to have a shot here, Joy.
All right. Steve Kornacki, wave your arms if any excitement takes place, and we'll come right back to you. Thank you, my friend. Much appreciated. And we'll be right back.
We're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole. That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
As dangerous and clearly deranged as Trump is, we have to start asking not just what's wrong with a society that produces so much support for this chaos theater, but also who is it that so badly wants Trump to be president, not just at the bottom, but at the top. There is a term in Latin, cui bono. It means who benefits. Because beyond the angry masses who want to luxuriate in the punishment of migrants, women, trans kids, and Black collegians, the real beneficiaries of a Trump autocracy would be those the late, great comedian George Carlin used to call the owners of the country, men of great wealth, who have long sought to return to a time when people like them didn't pay income taxes or face government regulation over their businesses and didn't have to worry about labor unions, workers' rights, or competition from women or Blacks. They could employ child labor, work their employees way past a 40-hour work week, and reap unlimited profits and leave vast estates to their heirs, tax-free. They could call themselves good Christians and never think twice about dirty words like diversity, history, accountability, or equity. These are the men behind organizations like Project 2025, the Claremont Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and whatever Leonard Leo is up to at any given time. Trump, in many ways, is just their useful, scary clown. And while some of these groups are loudly proclaiming these plans to take our country back to the 19th century, others are flying under the radar, like a group called Society for American Civic Renewal, or SACR for short. This group was uncovered earlier this month by Talking Points Memo, which described them as a secret, men-only right-wing society with members in influential positions around the country who are on a crusade to recruit a Christian government that will form after the right achieves regime change in the United States, potentially via a national divorce. Joining me now is the journalist who wrote this story, Josh Kavinsky, investigative reporter for Talking Points Memo. Josh, thanks for being here. And I wish that this sounded fanciful, but it doesn't. Please explain who SACR is and what they want.
Yeah, so what SACR wants is kind of what we said in the story, which is that they want to populate the government of what they call a future aligned regime. So what is that? A future aligned regime is kind of, as you said, it would be a government going back, you know, before the 1960s, before the 1930s, before the progressive era writ large. It would be a government that, you know, might sound familiar to people who lived in America in the 1890s. So the other kind of interesting thing about SACR is who's allowed to join. It's only available to men. It's only available to certain kinds of Christians, and they have other criteria as well. You have to be influential. You have to have some kind of wealth. It's very restrictive. And again, it's only certain kinds of Christians and certain kinds of men. So what they're doing here is they're trying to kind of, you know, inculcate this like embryonic like version of what they want society to be like, of what they want, you know, people who would govern America to be like in this very small secret society.
And these are not like the disgruntled, like the people you see at Trump rallies, right? Like those people can't join. You have to be rich, right? Can you give us some of the names of people? Because the Claremont Institute guy is involved. These are like wealthy white men, male Christians, right?
Yeah, that's what's critical about it. So Ryan Williams, he's the president of the Claremont Institute. He's a member of the national board. There's some other people. There's Nate Fisher in Dallas. He is a Harvard Law graduate. He worked in private equity for a few years. You know, there's Scott Yenner. He's a professor at Boise State University. He became notorious a couple of years ago for saying that he thinks that professions like engineering and law and medicine should stop recruiting women into their ranks. So yeah, I mean, look, these are not, you know, people who are kind of economically downscale. These are not downwardly mobile people. These are people who are basically the winners in our society. And I think when you think about the kind of resentment that, you know, this group represents, again, it's not resentment directed upwards from people who have lost out for whatever reason. What it is it's rage from people with money and status and position directed downwards to the rest of our society. It's them saying that they want a certain hierarchy that they believe does not exist right now or is being corroded, and they're trying to kind of create that or revive it.
What would happen with women in this kind of a society they want?
Well, I think a really telling thing is what they look for in their members. And what they ask for is their member. Their members are all male, and they want their members to be dominant in their household. They phrase that a few different ways in the documents that we obtained. But the message there is clear. They believe in a very traditional, strict version of hierarchies, and they believe that men should be at the top of them. I think another tell, Joy, is that one thing they say in terms of their objectives is they want to form the government of, as I said, a future aligned regime. And since they're all men, you know, clearly they believe that men should be the ones in charge of local, state, and
the weirdest thing about them.
So, you know,
yeah. The weirdest thing about them, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I want to make sure we get this in. This logo, the mark. Can we put this on the screen? This is the weirdest thing about them. Are they tattooing this on themselves? Like, what's going on here?
Well, you know, I think our reporting fell short in that we didn't get like a lot of visibility into whatever rituals they have at their meetings beyond copies of prayers that they recite. It's a weird kind of like amalgam of symbols there. It's partly various kinds of crosses and then kind of a pattern around it. You know, I think like with that, it's important to like keep in mind, you know, there's this like self-reinforcing thing going on where what they're saying in their founding documents is that, you know, we are the people who understand how power should truly be exercised. We are the people who understand, you know, where dominance is really needed and how power can be legitimately exercised. And so, you know, when you have things like that, like the mark and other kind of weird esoteric things which define who's going to be in and out, what they're really saying to themselves is, you know, there's a little bit of vanity here. What they're saying is, you know, we deserve to be in charge. We are the ones who really understand how power in our society works.
And Donald Trump would be their perfect King Joffrey. What a charming future they have in mind for the rest of us. Josh Kavinsky, great reporting. Thank you so much. And we'll be right back.
For too many people, the dream of having a good home is still feels out of reach. I get it. I want to provide an annual tax credit that will give Americans $400 a month for the next 2 years as mortgage rates come down to put toward their mortgage when they buy their first home or trade up for a little more space if they come from a middle-class background. They come from a family that has well under $200,000 or less.
With the economy being one of the top issues for voters this election cycle, President Biden is trying to sharpen his economic message by putting a new focus on his administration's efforts to make housing more affordable. While prices and inflation overall have cooled significantly this past year, the cost of housing is still on the rise, climbing even faster than the inflation rate and making it incredibly tough for many Americans, especially younger folks, to afford their rent or buy a house. The person who was tapped to lead on this issue over the past 3 years is former Ohio Congresswoman and Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Marcia Fudge, who just last week announced that she will be stepping down from her post this Friday. And joining me now is the aforementioned Secretary Marcia Fudge. So good to see you.
Good to see you. Thank you for having me.
This is tough work.
It is.
Housing is a big deal.
It is.
So before we get to some of the things that you've accomplished in the job, why are you leaving?
Well, I'm leaving because I think that it's time. You know, I've been at this a long, long time. I believe that I have given it all that I have to give, and we have put in place all of the things that are necessary to make the change that I think needs to be made. So it's time to give it to some younger person to come and do the work that we've started, and I feel real good about that.
Are you running for office? Are you? Is there some other story that I'm not getting from you right now
office.
In breaking news?
Okay. I am not running for office.
Okay, okay. We wanted to make sure of that. So let's talk specifically about housing, because I do hear this a lot, particularly from younger people. They're saying the numbers and the data look good, the unemployment rate, Wall Street, you could tell me all that, but it's hard to afford my life. What's been done to try to bring down the cost of rent and owning a home?
First, I think it's important to understand that this country, for decades, has not invested in low-income and moderate-income housing. And so there is housing, but it's just not for people,
not
everyday people. And because the supply is so small, what happens? The prices go up. And that's just basic supply and demand. What we have done is made it easier by down payment assistance. We have changed the way we look at student loan debt, which is one of our big issues. Who has student loan debt? Black, brown, and poor people. But we always weighted it higher than any other kind of debt. So
right.
We made it more difficult for people to buy. So we've changed the way we do that. We've changed the way that we look at who is creditworthy.
Mm-hmm.
Most minorities come to us, or many do, and say, we say, you don't have any credit. But now we're saying if you've paid your rent on time for 12 months, we consider you creditworthy.
Right.
So FHA then can work on underwriting a mortgage for you. We have done some down payment assistance. We have created new products to keep people in homes. We've done an awful lot.
How do we get? The thing is that I think sometimes there's a disconnect between how government works and what people feel in their lives. But how do we bridge that? I mean, you've been a member of Congress. You've actually been a mayor. So you've actually spoken to your constituents at a level that's closer to home. How does government and what it does connect to people's lives? How do you do that?
Well, I think one of the things we've done that's fun, we do house parties all over the country. Literally, we call them house parties, and they are parties where we teach people how to go about the process. What prepares you to be able to buy a home? And it has worked. Over the 3 years I've been there, Joy, we have supported 1.8 million mortgages. 1.5 million of them are new first-time home buyers, and more than 250,000 are Black people. Because we have taught them through our technical assistance, through our housing counseling, how to go about the process, because so many of them qualify, they just don't know they do.
Yeah.
And it's also getting into things like public housing and trying to teach people, this is how you move to the next step. I go into public housing a lot because that's where I learn what people are doing. I learn how people are living. And I think that it has become an issue for many people that I do.
Yeah.
But that's what I do.
You are from, of course, the great state of Ohio. It's election day in your in your home state. What are you looking to see happen? Do you think Sherrod Brown can win against either of the two front runners in that Senate primary?
Well, fortunately, I'm still under the Hatch Act, so there's
only
so much I can
say. Oh, you can't answer that. I forgot Hatch Act. Yes,
so,
you're right. You're absolutely right.
But I am hopeful that we're going to come up with two good candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Ohio is such a great state. I think we'll do some good things.
So once you, I'll give you the sort of final answer for the elevator pitch for those who feel that there hasn't, that they can't afford to buy, to rent. What is your elevator pitch of why they should feel hopeful?
Well, they should feel hopeful because we are creating an environment in which we are building more houses. We have more than 500,000 units of housing under construction today. We are looking at an issue as to how we can create better housing, how we can assist people in preparing through, I mean, housing counseling. And the other thing we've done that people forget about is homelessness comes under us.
Yeah.
So just in January, we issued more than $3 billion to deal with that situation.
Yeah.
So we are helping people move from the very worst they can be to the best they
can
be.
The last thing before we go, you are the first Black woman to lead the HUD in more than four decades. What has been the importance of representation? Because that is a huge representation. It's a huge instance of representation.
I think the important thing is that I know the people that I represent.
Yeah.
They are my people.
And I will say among your people are me, because I'm a member of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated, and you are a former national president.
Thank you,
so you know
sister.
I wore my red in homage.
Red and white, we had it all covered.
Between the two of us, we're in the right color. Secretary Marsha Fudge, thank you. And that is tonight's readout.
My name is Molly, and I'm a political science major at Kent State University. Kent State has these core values, kindness, respect, and purpose in all we do. Ever since I was old enough to understand the legal system, I've wanted to help serve justice, and I would like to be a prosecutor for the city of Cleveland and then hopefully move up to the county in the Justice Center downtown. Kindness and respect go a long way. As a prosecutor, you have to be kind to all parties of the courtroom to truly help everybody involved.